From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The sun has risen on an independent United Kingdom. And just look at it. Even the weather's improved.
That was Nigel Farage, the leader of the United Kingdom's Independence Party, or UKIP, as he called for June 23rd to go down in history as Britain's Independence Day.
It's been a hell of a long journey, this. I first got involved in Eurosceptic politics 25 years ago, and the first election I contested, I managed to beat the late, great, screaming Lord Such by 164 votes, so I didn't come last. And now there are 17 million people that voted for Brexit.
He called Thursday's referendum vote to leave the EU a victory for ordinary, decent people and a victory against the big merchant banks.
It's a victory for ordinary people, decent people. It's a victory against the big merchant banks, against the big businesses and against big politics. And I'm proud of everybody that had the courage, in the face of all the threats, everything they were told, they had the guts to stand up and do the right thing.
The Brits voted to leave the EU with the so-called Brexit winning a majority in Thursday's referendum. CCTV's Li Danying has more.
The BBC has declared victory for the Leave camp in the UK's referendum on the country's 43-year EU membership, with 52% of voters backing a so-called Brexit. Over 17 million votes are for Leave, as against the nearly 16 million for Remain. The majority of voters in England and Wales voted to Leave, while every council in Scotland saw Remain majorities. And there was a high turnout for Thursday's historic referendum, standing at 72%. The European Parliament President Martin Schulz has reacted to the news, saying he expects negotiations over Britain's departure from the EU to begin quickly.
Donald Tusk, the European Council President, said that the other 27 members of the current 28-member EU were determined to keep their unity as 27 during a press statement at Council headquarters in Brussels early Thursday.
Today, on behalf of the 27 leaders, I can say that we are determined to keep our unity as 27. For all of us, the Union is the framework for our common future. I would also like to reassure you that there will be no legal vacuum until the United Kingdom formally leaves the European Union. EU law will continue to apply to and within the UK. And by this I mean rights as well as obligations. All the procedures for the withdrawal of the UK from the EU are clear and set out in the treaties. In order to discuss the details of further proceedings, I have offered the leaders an informal meeting of the 27 in the margins of the European Council summit. And I will also propose to the leaders that we start a wider reflection on the future of our union.
Meanwhile, across the world, relations between Russia and China appear to be their warmest in decades, as China's President Xi Jinping met with Russia's President Vladimir Putin Thursday, ahead of the annual summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Uzbekistan. Xi said Putin's upcoming state visit to China bears special significance after Putin's call earlier this week for closer coordination in major international and regional affairs between the two countries. CCTV's Daria Bodarchuk reports from Moscow.
A strategic collaboration. That's how the Kremlin's described its relationship with China, as Vladimir Putin heads to Beijing for talks with President Xi. The Russian leader says their strong ties contribute to the stability of world affairs. But as well as geopolitics, over 30 economic agreements are on the agenda, both governmental and corporate, focusing on financial, industrial and agricultural cooperation. But it's not just business. President Xi Jinping and President Vladimir Putin will also discuss cooperation between Beijing and Moscow within the United Nations, BRICS and the G20 frameworks. Vladimir Putin will be hoping to return to the Kremlin with plenty of trade agreements between Beijing and Moscow. It is important economically, as Russia still faces Western sanctions, but also politically, as it sends a message to the Kremlin's opponents that Russia may not be as isolated internationally as some of them may like to think. Дарья Бондарчук, CCTV, Moscow.
The strains in the EU and the closer collaboration between Russia and China may explain these statements earlier this week by U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter.
In this new era, we face no fewer than five immediate, evolving challenges. First, countering the prospect of Russian aggression and coercion, especially in Europe. Second, managing historic change in the vital Asia-Pacific region, where China is rising, which is fine, but behaving aggressively, which is not.
After listing Russia and China as public enemies number one and two, Carter still had room for three more.
Strengthening our deterrent and defense forces in the face of North Korea's nuclear and missile provocations and threat to our allies. Checking Iranian aggression and malign influence in the Gulf. And we must and we are combating terrorism, including accelerating the defeat of ISIL. Last week's tragic shooting in Orlando underscores the urgency of that last one. And Orlando further steels our resolve to carry out all the aspects of our coalition military campaign plan. First, destroying ISIL's parent tumor in Iraq and Syria, which is necessary, not sufficient, because second, we need to combat ISIL's metastases worldwide, wherever it appears, and third, help protect the homeland and our people. Now, we don't have the luxury of choosing among these five different challenges. We must and will address them all across the spectrum of conflict.
I was sent that clip on Wednesday by Umberto Pascali, the commentator and political analyst. Umberto, you want to break that down for us? It sounds like he's ready to go to war with the world.
Yeah. And the most astonishing thing, by the way, this was the speech on the 20th in Washington, D.C., in front of 1,000 national security officials, basically the whole creme de la creme of the Pentagon, neocon side. And at the national conference of the Center for New American Security, that is the center of the neocon now, and the conference was dedicated of how to shape the new administration, what the new administration should do. Of course, clearly, openly, they are supporting Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, it's like a tag team with the campaign with this.
Absolutely. That's the campaign of Hillary Clinton. There are all the people that, by the way, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have been attacking. They are all there. With the crystal, with the Robert Kagan that prepared the program that now Ashton Carter is reading. The program was prepared by Kagan. Kagan is the husband of Victoria Nuland, the movie director of the coup d'etat in Kiev.
And the cookie server.
Yeah, and the one who was trying to corrupt the police with their cookies, and she is the girl of Hillary, in the sense that there are rumors in Washington, I hope it's not true, that if Hillary is elected, Victoria Nuland, wife of Robert Kagan, neocon and inspirer of Ashton Carter, is Victoria Nuland will be the next Secretary of State. Hope not, because we'll be sure war. Anyway, now Ashton Carter talking to this exactly the bipartisan neocon gang that is now behind Hillary Clinton says that there are five immediate challenges. The first challenge is European aggression, especially against Europe. This is a quote. European aggression, especially against Europe. The last threat is ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, and so on. So this shows the priority of the defense secretary. But what is more important, what you were asking, is why do we have ISIS at all? You know, fortunately, it has been limited by the airstrikes and by the policy of the Russians in Syria, because for the administration of Barack Obama, they were not going to be defeated. They were going to be contained. If you remember, that was what Obama officially said more than once. We are not going to solve this problem militarily, you know, group of terrorists, but we are going to solve it politically. We have to contain them. Contain means only one thing, to use them.
Right.
Beside the fact that if you go to see the origin of ISIS, you find the fingerprint of special agencies, Anglo-American agencies, Anglo-American Israeli agency all over the place, obviously. But officially, the position is we are not going to destroy them, to contain them. Contain means when we need them, I don't know, in Iraq we need them, we use them. In Syria we use them. Then maybe we split them and one part will be the good terrorist and the other will be the bad terrorist.
Right.
And this is the priorities of the supposed new administration if Hillary Clinton is selected. The second priority, by the way, is China.
Yeah.
China is growing, says Carter. And this is good, but it's aggressive. And this is bad, and we are going to stop it. Then North Korea. Okay, but then the malevolent, malign influence of Iran, This is much more important challenge for the United States than ISIS.
Yep.
Because ISIS, it's only the last point. You know, this clarifies a lot of things. First of all, why we had this electoral campaign in this strange way. We had a basic rebellion in the United States against this policy of the neocon. Actually, people think neocons is a group of Republicans that are hiding somewhere and do some little thing. No. These are the people that dominate the Obama administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, all the administration, the war administration. All the administrations that put together the interest of Wall Street against the American population and the need of a war all over the place. And Ashton Carter says, these five priorities, not that we can take one after the other, all together. And thus, we need a lot of money, a lot of big budget, for our military operations all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
One of the key points, by the way, is the weakness of Europe that could hear, you know, the allure of the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to reinforce the resolve of the Europeans.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saw in recently, the case of the foreign minister of Germany,
Steinmeier,
Franz Walter Steinmeier, who explicitly, on the day in which a big maneuver, this Anaconda military maneuver, for the first time since World War II, the German troops entered Poland, cross the borders.
Mm-hmm.
This time they are good because they are under the NATO umbrella, under the NATO flag.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody in Wall Street and among the neocon is supporting Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Russia made clear they are not going to give up. They tried with Gorbachev, they tried with Yeltsin, and they arrived almost to a dismemberment of their country. You know, a situation like with Napoleon or with Hitler. They are not going to accept anymore to be put in that role. They are going to fight, and they made this very, very clear.
Yeah. It's funny how it's playing out here also. You've got on the one side the entire political establishment and Hillary Clinton, and Sanders deviated some from that, but not as much as Trump, who calls into question the need for NATO, certainly calls for funding of NATO by European countries, which of course is politically impossible there. Just looking at France today, try telling them they have to pay 2% of their budget for that.
Mm-hmm.
And also the very idea of permanent war, which you're hearing is our policy yesterday at this conference, as absurd, and he invoked General Patton and General MacArthur and asked, what would they think of the idea of permanent warfare? So when you have this political situation shaping up in the United States, you have the troops mobilized. I mean, the places you described, the five places that he described, Carter, you're talking about basically from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, which coincidentally or not happens to encircle Russia and China.
Right. You are exactly right. And the problem is what they are facing. I think there is... First, let me stress that what the foreign minister of Germany said is that NATO is becoming a warmonger. We don't need this kind of warmonger statement against Russia. We have to find a solution on Russia. And, by the way, today, the foreign minister of Germany, Gabriel, another member of the Social Democratic Party, like Steinmeier, announced that he's going to Moscow for a very important economic mission. We can talk about this later. But, what I see now in the U.S., because of this resistance of Russia and clear resistance, because a few days ago, on the 16th, on the skies of Syria, we had almost for the first time a direct military confrontation between the U.S. and Russia. This never happened during the Cold War, but happened a few days ago on the skies of Syria, near the border of Jordan, where a terrorist center was attacked by Russian military plane. And then we had the intervention of the U.S. Air Forces, and there was really a very, very close encounter, confrontation. So the Russian left, but then shortly after, they come back and they destroy the terrorist center. Mm. Of course, there were screams all over the place, but nobody dare really to do anything like attacking directly the Russian forces. But this is the situation which we are. We are more close to a real war because of the neocons, a real war like nuclear war, than we ever been, not even the Cuban missile crisis. That's why I think in the U.S. there are two ways of thinking. And I would distinguish, this is my hypothesis, between the elite or part of the elite in the United States and the establishment. We had an establishment, the establishment of Bush, Clinton. These are not two different groups, one left, one right, Democratic, Republican. It's exactly the same from the very beginning. There is the crime family of the Bush, like, I don't know, the Gambino. And then there is the sub-family, the Clinton, the nouveau riche, that are accepted and that they have to do a lot of the dirty work
right.
And they have to get rich fast because they start from scratch. Mm. That's why Hillary Clinton is so mad to make as much money as possible. It's a tragic, ridiculous figure. Mm. This establishment has been in power basically since the assassination of the Kennedys. Right. I mean, slowly, the Bush acquired their prominent position as the royal family of the United States after the assassination of John Kennedy, and in 68 Robert Kennedy, they begin to emerge. There are all the stories, I'm sure you have gone through in your previous transmission, of the role of the young George Bush father in Miami with the Cuban that were involved in the assassination. But this will be for another time.
Yeah, and you know what? There's something I want to point out, by the way, before we get too far from Steinmeier. This is the same German foreign minister who, while he was negotiating the deal that was supposed to be the final deal with President Yanukovych, Vicky Nuland was saying he's the guy that she was talking about, in essence, when she said, you know what, the EU, because he ended up as the guarantor of a peace process in Ukraine that was the next day violated with a coup.
Right, right. The FU, the EU, by, I don't know, we cannot say this, what the Victoria Nuland said, right. But the FU, the EU, was directed to Germany and then France and Italy, because they, of course, they understood, the most rational part, understood perfectly that the coup d'etat in Kiev and the kind of confrontation that was being prepared against Russia was also against them.
Right.
Because, you know, as Putin repeated the other day in St. Petersburg, the U.S., with the sanction against Russia, don't lose anything. The European lose a lot, more than Russia.
Yep.
So this was the same reason why NATO exists now, when it's absolutely doesn't make any sense, when there is no Warsaw Pact, there is no enemy. NATO is as strong as ever. The first secretary of NATO said, when he was asked, why do we have a NATO? Well, to keep the Russian out, the American in, and the Germans down. Now, the new version is to keep the Europeans down. Now, Steinmeier at that time had to give up. You know, was shameful, was coward, and the same with Italy, you know. They had to give up also other pressure, like Italy had this deal with oil, basically was very cheap source of energy from Libya, and Italy, there was a deal between Prime Minister Berlusconi and President Gheddafi, and then Italy was forced to go to war. Didn't really go to war, but was forced officially to go to war with Libya. And so this is the situation, that Europe has been in a cage with this continuous provocation, using mostly Ukraine as the casus belli, in which Europe and Russia have to fight forever.
And but they're fighting back, because not just Steinmeier, but also the Italian prime minister was in St. Petersburg for the International Economic Conference, which is where Steinmeier made the comments.
Exactly. Well, Steinmeier did the comment a few days before that meeting. But, you know, stop the warmongers. We don't need the warmongers of NATO. And then in St. Petersburg, as the economic forum of St. Petersburg, Matteo Renzi, the prime minister of Italy, said, we are sick and tired of this automatic renegotiation of the sanctions. We don't need the sanctions, we don't like the sanctions, and we have to find a way out. In the meantime, the way out is economic deals. Despite all the sanctions and so on, Renzi concluded in Moscow contracts between the Italian industry and the Russian industry for $1.5 billion. And a couple of months before, the prime minister of Bavaria. Bavaria is the richest area of Germany. It's also the most industrialized. It's basically state within the state. The prime minister of Bavaria, Horst Seehofer, went to Moscow despite the Chancellor Angela Merkel said, don't go, this is against our line. He went there, he concluded a deal for more than 600 million euros in contract. Now, Gabriel is the leader of the Social Democratic Party, and he announced that he's going to Moscow in behalf of the German industry and will conclude a huge contract there. So this is the form of rebellion. The form that this European rebellion takes is, for the moment, an economic form, because in the meantime, the sanctions were renewed. But it's not so simple. It's not the sanctions are renewed, but they are being emptied. They are like, they become an empty shell, because the two parts of Eurasia, they work together economically.
Yeah, you know, one of the interesting things is when we've discussed before the that a lot of this goes back to the 1980s and the struggle between industrial and financial capital inside Germany, with industrial capital looking to the east and financial capital taking its instructions from its bed partner in the west.
Right. You are absolutely right. This is the key. When someone look at Germany, see a country that is betraying their own interest. Angela Merkel doesn't work for Germany. That's what people don't understand. You know, the dictatorship of Germany. No, the dictatorship of Angela Merkel is the dictatorship in behalf of Wall Street. The Germany had a complete different policy. Until the beginning of the 90s, the policy had been created by a gentleman called Alfred Herrhausen. He had a powerful position. He was the top advisor on economy of Chancellor Kohl, Helmut Kohl. He was the head of the Deutsche Bank, this huge bank, the biggest, most powerful in Europe, one of the biggest in the world. And his policy was, we are not going to do what the Wall Street Bank do. Our interest is not to destroy our client because they cannot pay interest on the debt. In case we can forgive the debt, because we are in the business of investing in development, in industry, and when this investment begin to give fruits, then we have our profit. This will be long-term investments. He was killed in November 1989. Alfred Herrhausen, the most powerful man in Europe, I would say, was killed by the terrorist of the so-called Bader-Meinhof in near Bonn, Baden-Württemberg, while the Bader-Meinhof did not exist anymore. They were all in jail. He was going to New York to give a speech in front of the IMF World Bank crowd. The speech was never delivered because he was killed. But, you know, I remember Colonel Fletcher Prouty. I had an interview with him at that time, a few years later. He gave me the speech that he was supposed to give in front of this basically Wall Street bosses. And the speech was basically, thank you for what you have done for us, but now we will do it by ourselves. Mm. We are perfectly able to have an independent, economically and politically independent Europe doing business with the East. After he was killed, of course, the fear hit the sky. And Germany is in the situation which is now. But the alternative now is economic suicide. If they keep obeying to the order of Wall Street and the neocon, it's economic suicide in Germany, in Italy, in France.
And on that note, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Don.
A week ago this past Friday, the New York Times published what it said was a draft version of a dissent memo filed with the State Department's senior leadership, wherein dozens of diplomats and other mid-level officials called for military strikes against Syria. The Times said the document was provided to the paper by a State Department official on the condition that the names of those who signed were not published. The memo's contents were tacitly confirmed and the policy it advocated challenged by the Obama administration. This was White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest earlier this past week.
And the president approves of this well-established process at the State Department. There should be an opportunity for people who do have a dissent to register to do so. And that's a healthy part of the process. And look, the president has long acknowledged how difficult the situation in Syria is. And so the president would certainly welcome new ideas that are put forward for confronting it.
But there are no new ideas in that cable, that memo, that...
The proposals, I haven't read the cable, but based on the way that it's been reported, those are things that have been previously considered. And look, the president is determined to make sure that the United States does not make the unwise assessment that somehow we can succeed in imposing a military solution on Syria. The United States tried that when President Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and that did not lead to results that were in our country's best interest. So the president wants to avoid that, and the president believes that we need to be focused on ISIL, and that if we take resources that are currently dedicated toward ISIL and redirect them toward the Assad regime, that's going to not advance our broader goal.
Right, but as I understand, it wasn't so much to impose a military solution; it was to use the military for more leverage. Is there anything positive to report about the whole cessation of hostilities process, or is that essentially ended?
Well, no. The cessation of hostilities is something that we're working hard to try to keep from completely falling apart. There are places where the cessation of hostilities has frayed in a way that has had a very negative impact on the security situation inside of Syria. In those places where the cessation of hostilities has had some positive impact, the benefit has been that humanitarian aid has been able to flow into some of those areas, and some of those are areas that badly needed it. So I think the latest estimate that I've seen is more than 800,000 Syrians have been able to get some form of humanitarian relief in the last few months since the cessation of hostilities was put into place. That obviously is a positive consequence of that, but look, there are far too many places where we have seen the cessation of hostilities intermittently observed, and that's been frustrating. But I do want to go back to one element of your question, which is, and this is sort of the way that it's the way that this is often considered, is that somehow the use of the United States military could be used to enhance the leverage of the United States. I'm not really sure what that means. I think what it means is it means that we should direct the force of the United States military against the Assad regime. And I think there are a lot of questions that are raised about that. First of all, how do you do that without harming innocent civilians? Second of all, I'm not sure exactly what legal authority the president would rely on to do something like that. And three, it seems like a slippery slope. Does that just mean that there's one round of missile strikes and then we spend a month trying to negotiate again, and then if nothing happens, do we launch more missile strikes, or then do we have to steadily ramp up the military engagement? And at what point does that stop? It's hard to imagine where that stops, that somehow stops short of a war against a sovereign nation that is being backed by Russia and Iran in a way that it's unclear to me how exactly that is going to apply additional pressure against ISIL, which is the extremist organization that we obviously are quite concerned about.
Danny Haifong is an activist and writer based in Boston. He recently authored an article published at the International Herald Tribune entitled "President Assad Stays Firm Against Imperialist-Backed Terrorists as the War on Syria Continues." We spoke with him via Skype from Boston last weekend. Hey, Dan, welcome back. Pleasure.
Pleasure to be here.
So you wrote about President Assad with everything that's been going on. The U.S. is making noise like they're going to begin some serious military activity against Syria, ostensibly against ISIS, but some in the State Department even saying they need to start targeting the Syrian government. Russia has been attacking ISIS, revealing Turkey aiding ISIS in terms of providing medical support and other things. Lizzie Phelan was out at the border with cameras this past week. Tell us about some of the details of the piece that you wrote this past week about Assad.
Well, I think you laid out the context of sort of the conditions that prompted Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to reaffirm his commitment, as well as the Syrian government's commitment, to what he said was making Aleppo the graveyard of that butcher's dream, which he was referring to President Erdogan of Turkey, a staunch U.S. ally, staunch European ally, and a staunch NATO ally, which has been aiding, funding, training the al-Nusra Front terrorists, which have once again begun to invade Syria from their shared border. So my article basically outlines what the context of this war is. And, you know, given that it's an election season, the U.S. foreign policy drive against Syria has been very misconceived, and it has been spoken about as another point in the war on terror, when really the whole time it has been, ever since 2011 and even before that, when the U.S. and its allies had sanctions placed on the Syrian government, it has always been a war to overthrow Bashar al-Assad, overthrow his party, and ultimately turn Syria into a divided, sectarian, a chaotic state. And there are many interests that this would serve. It would serve Turkey's interests of expansion. It would serve Saudi Arabia's interests of expansion. Qatar, Israel is in there helping to give medical care to these Takfiri terrorists. And the United States ultimately wants the Syrian government to fall for a variety of reasons. Some of them are geopolitical. There's a huge war drive to isolate Russia, and the Syrian government is one of its staunch allies. Iran, with its new political legitimacy that it just gained through the nuclear talks, that has allowed Iran to expand its market, and that is a huge problem for not only the U.S. energy corporations, but also its military state that desperately wants to see Iran fall as well. So there are many competing interests and aligned interests when it comes to U.S. foreign policy in regards to Syria. And the Syrian government, which has been in a virtual stalemate fighting imperialism alongside Russia, is seeing no reason to let up and let its guard down, even in the midst of all these talks that have happened in recent months, so-called peace negotiations, so-called ceasefires. None of it has really done anything to impact the conditions on the ground where these jihadist Takfiri terrorists, funded by imperialism, armed by imperialism, continue to leak through the borders, continue to cause the most horrific atrocities inside of Syria, continue to disallow the Syrian government to reconstruct and rebuild the country after years of war. These are the objective conditions that really make it difficult for any development to happen in the region, and that's been the plan all along.
You know, you have, speaking of the objective conditions, of course, the coming into existence and the rise of ISIS, and before that, beginning more or less with the U.S. war on Iraq, I would say phase two going into phase three, phase one being George H.W. Bush's invasion, phase two being Bill Clinton's bomb and starve campaign, and phase three being George Bush's the second's invasion in March of 2003, the rise of al-Qaeda. Throughout all of that, there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq before, for example, and no al-Qaeda in Yemen, and no al-Qaeda in Syria. Now they're all over the place, and you have this new franchise, ISIS, that came up. And these are both direct results of U.S. policy, both towards Iraq and Syria, and now also towards Yemen. You know, within a geopolitical context, you have, on the one hand, now the you know, the condition where the U.S. is facing the so-called Shia crescent because of the takeout of Saddam Hussein and of the Ba'athist Party there, the Shia majority taking control of Iraq, and the gravity towards an alliance with Iran, where the U.S. before had Iraq at Iran's throat. And, of course, Syria and Iran are two of the large economies there and regional players competing with the Saudis and the Israelis, and chaos now throughout the region. How does this suit U.S. foreign policy and geopolitical objectives?
Well, there are many things that this policy suits. There is the many interests, especially economic. You know, in another recent piece I wrote about U.S. foreign policy, I make the conclusion that U.S. foreign policy is really geared to create favorable conditions for capitalism. What we see now with all of this chaos is that the U.S. military state, its policy, now has no ability to create favorable conditions for capitalism. However, that still remains a top priority. The Syrian government, as well as the Iraqi government before 2003, the Libyan government before 2011, the Iranian government today, all of them had strong state-owned energy as well as economic development resources that couldn't just be exploited at the whims of the IMF or the World Bank or the multinational corporations on Wall Street that control these institutions. So that's a huge problem, and that has been one of the biggest reasons why the U.S. foreign policy targets these countries. Another is geopolitical. We know that that Russia and China are expanding their influence throughout the world, China becoming the most powerful economic system in the world in terms of purchasing power. Russia's military, as well as its energy and trading system, is really attractive to Europe. Both of these countries have regional integration plans that could really cut off U.S. multinational corporations from huge parts of the Eurasian market. All of this signals a terminal stage for the dominance of U.S. capital. And because of this, the United States is forced to wage these wars of aggression, because right now it has no other means of operating in the world. I mean, most of the world sees, from direct experience, the United States as a parasitic enterprise. It has a foreign policy that follows a pretty basic roadmap. There is the wars that it wages to overthrow secular and independent governments. first by sanction, then by proxy, then by direct military intervention. And that's really the only future that any country, especially in the Middle East region, can really see for them if they work with the United States. And so unless we're talking about a compliant ally of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, the Gulf monarchies, Israel, Turkey, the last remaining independent countries like Syria have no desire to to align themselves with the imperialist order, given that all that such a policy will do is keep it in the Stone Ages, send it back into the barbaric period of colonialism and backwardness. That's really all that the U.S. can offer. So when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, this sponsoring of jihadists and terrorists should really be seen as a profound weakness, because as we see with the Orlando massacre, this policy is dangerous and it is not successful most of the time. Libya is completely a failed state where its economy is almost useless to global capitalism. Syria would ultimately fall in that same line should the Syrian government be destabilized.
That strategy, which sounds remarkably like a scorched earth policy, essentially, as you see the rise of a multipolar world, Russia and China, India and Brazil, although that's in question, and South Africa, the BRICS countries, emerging as a potential, ongoing rise of a competitor to global capitalism. That essentially some of the places where they might and or were getting deeply involved being destroyed to deny them. But the dynamics of Western capitalism are such that it must grow faster and it must more thoroughly exploit from its new terrain and existing terrain at a higher rate or collapses. And that's not the dynamic on the other side, where there's heavy state involvement, there's all kinds of public investment and publicly held wealth, and the potential for a huge potential for self-development before they get to this stage, assuming that the same dynamics apply. So as the U.S. goes around and scorches the earth in places like Libya, Syria, attempts to do that in Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, and other places, how exactly do they work their way out of this? It seems like they're digging a bigger and bigger hole.
Well, there is no way for the U.S. imperialism to dig its way out of the hole that it has created for itself. Really, U.S. imperialism is collapsing under the weight of its own contradictions. The imperialist system requires its military arm to create these supposedly favorable conditions for capitalist investment. But what we see now is that capitalist investment cannot find favorable grounds under the conditions of war. And without that, its economy is not strong enough, not attractive enough, given the intractable crisis that it currently is in, leaving billions unemployed, starvation wages, or simply imprisoned, like here in the United States. There's no future for capitalism around the world when we look at exactly how people live under it. And China, a new report from the Chinese Communist Party, basically showed that it has taken over 60 million people out of rural poverty There were reports years ago, 4 years ago, that a similar amount of people were taken out of urban poverty. So China's economic system is very attractive around the world because its infrastructure development breeds real results when it comes to economic development.
Yeah, I mean, over the past in the period since the 1980s, as a matter of fact, they've lifted 600 million people out of poverty.
Exactly, and that's attractive to the African continent, countries in the African continent that have been subjected to centuries of colonialism and neocolonialism, and have been left backward by the world financial institutions. That's attractive to Latin America, when there are very similar conditions that arise, but the movement in Latin America is much farther along, and it needs allies to really continue the progressive and revolutionary development that has occurred there. And the same goes for the Middle East, because, as we know, colonialism really redrew the map centuries ago, and imperialism in the 20th century attempted to maintain that redrawn map of states that were exploited mainly for their resources and mainly for their cheap labor. And so now we're at this stage where the capitalist system that the United States attempts to impose on the world through military means primarily can no longer offer anything that its competitors really can. And that is real economic development, that is stability, and that is the potential for a future that does not include extreme poverty, extreme military crisis, and dependency. That's really all that U.S. imperialism can offer, and a dependency that is increasingly becoming rife with sectarian and proxy war chaos, and that's not what the world wants. So here we are, in the 21st century, 2016, where Syria is a battleground and a huge example, to quote Donald Trump, huge, of what that crisis of the imperialist system really looks like right now. A virtual stalemate with Syria, and a conflict that speaks to the larger geopolitical situation, Russia and China being heavily involved in this as well. So it remains to be seen what will happen, but what I see is that it's going to be a very protracted struggle, one that will have both disappointments and victories to come.
And finally, just looking at the very legs that the empire stands on, that's the U.S. public. You know, for some 40 years, you could go back even maybe Taft-Hartley or earlier. So you're talking perhaps 70 or 80 years. There's been a concentrated effort, certainly since the early 80s, on workers in the United States, union labor, the entire working class, that resulted in the condition now where the working class in two large groups is basically in public rebellion. They've lost confidence in the political structures, both the people under Sanders and under Trump rejecting those, and a wall-to-wall effort like a unified ruling class lining up behind Hillary Clinton and someone like Trump saying, in terms of foreign policy, do we need NATO? Shouldn't the other countries pay for NATO? Which, of course, if they had to do that, there'd be uprisings in those countries because that money would get diverted from already austerity budgets for military. Do we need permanent war? And he invokes Patton and MacArthur and saying, you know, and ridiculing that idea. So, and these are things that are playing to the American public. So is it possible that as the weight of this comes down, its legs are being cut out from underneath? And if so, what are the prospects domestically?
Domestically, the 2016 elections have really, as you and Tony Montero always talk about, shown that the U.S. political apparatus is in a crisis of legitimacy, and that crisis of legitimacy is directly connected to the crisis of capitalism that has really eroded the conditions of the working class to the point where we see all of its the working class's own internal contradictions arise into political forces, the Sanders camp, the Trump camp, as well as still the crisis of revolutionary politics in this country, where we have yet to see a radical unified movement come out of these developments. But what they do show is that there are huge numbers of workers sick of the 30-40 year trend of endless austerity, endless privatization, the proliferation of the low-wage sector, the fact that more and more people are becoming unemployed, and that unemployment is actually out of control, and that the numbers are all a lie, and the corporate media has basically suppressed the actual existing economic conditions in the United States. And then you have the surveillance state, the military state coming home, basically, the expansion of the surveillance of radical movements of the 60s and 70s to fit the whole entire population, that has bred distrust, that has bred resistance, disgust with the U.S. political apparatus. And there are, I know that there was a People's Summit recently of the Sanders camp coming together after him basically conceding the nomination to Clinton in recent days. And, you know, there will be more attempts on the part of these emergent movements to attempt to articulate and define what to do after the elections. And the same will go for Donald Trump, because by all accounts, Donald Trump right now is running a pretty weak campaign leading up to his confrontation with Clinton. And if he should lose as well, his people are not going to go away. They are going to continue to remain a force, not only in the Republican Party, but also a political force on the ground. And so how radical forces relate to this this phenomena is really key, because we have yet to define and articulate in a cohesive way as a movement what the capitalist crisis has actually meant for people in the United States, and how does it relate to what the U.S. political apparatus is doing abroad. We have still yet to do that, and objective conditions are getting more and more ripe. People, especially the working class, is becoming increasingly frustrated with business as usual. And there are many prospects that this can lead to coming out of the 2016 scenario. Because regardless of who wins, the problems that the 2016 elections have really been forced to speak to are not going away, and they're only going to get worse. And if Hillary Clinton is ultimately the victor, with the whole bourgeoisie, the whole ruling class by her side, I do not think she will have the same impact as the Obama administration before her in terms of really being able to suppress radical and left, not even radical, but left politics generally. I do not think she has the ability to do that as much as he had coming out of the 2008 crisis.
Jenny Haifong, thank you very much. Pleasure.
Pleasure, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.